Welcome to the London Welsh Rugby Club podcast. This is episode 38. No real news from the club this week to report, but plenty going on behind the scenes to ensure we're able to hit the ground running when we have games at the end of this season or even in September. Our guest this week is someone who has suffered true adversity after a tragic accident put aid to his rugby career, and many thought he'd be stuck in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. Well, through some luck, plenty of determination, and the can-do spirit, he has gone on to walk up Snowdon within a year of his accident and climbed many more mountains in Europe and the Himalayas and created his own charity. He is someone who is now giving motivational talks to businesses about resilience, perspective, and taking pleasure from the process. He is now a broadcaster on Channel 4 for their rugby and Paralympics coverage, a brand ambassador, and is massive on social media, bigger than me even. On the rugby front, he played for London Welsh for 2 years during the Championship success and the first Premiership season before he went to play for Wasps and Newport Gwent Dragons. He has kept in touch with the club and has formed many friendships within the squad that were there at the time. Our guest this week is Ed Jackson. Enjoy. This podcast is sponsored by London Welsh Developments. London Welsh Developments offer the entire range of services for all your home needs, from plumbing, electrical, joinery, and building and maintenance. Their many years of experience building all forms of extensions and conversions, the odd new build, and some bespoke garden rooms and home offices. You will clearly see the attention to detail and understanding of your home that is difficult to match. They really do care and want the best for your home with no stone left unturned. For more information, contact London Welsh Developments on 0208 335 9123 or email on info@lwdltd.co.uk. London Welsh Developments. Welcome to the pod, former London Welsh, Wasps and Newport Gwent Dragons forward, Ed Jackson. How are you, Ed?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yes, very good. Thank you very much. Now, I'm going to ask you how your festive break was, but I know before the festive break, you were quite active because you did a challenge for rugby restart, and not just any old challenge. For you, it has to be something like pretty phenomenal, doesn't it? What do you do before Christmas?
So I'm on the board of trustees for Restart, who look after all of the professional players in England. And myself, Ugo Monney and James Haskell are like the player representatives on there. And they're struggling for funds at the moment because of obviously not being able to fundraise last year. But also there's a lot of stress on their services. A lot of the stuff that they support is on the mental health side, supporting players. And we decided to try and do some fundraising pre-Christmas and take on some endurance challenges. Hass did like a 14-hour DJ set where he actually only DJed for an hour of it and then just had a party.
Easy.
Ugo's not actually done his yet, but he's going to jump on a spin bike for 100 kilometres, he promises. But old Muggins over here decided to try and walk home for Christmas from Bath to Bournemouth to my wife's house and just walk for 24 hours straight. Didn't really put much thought of it into it like I don't towards these challenges, and then I realized it was the second longest night of the year, like second shortest day, so I ended up walking 16 hours in pitch black, which was an interesting experience. Started hallucinating, and I'm still injured from it, so yeah, all in all a successful event, but we raised $6,000 for Restart. That's the main thing, but I was knackered for all of Christmas then, so I was a bit in a bit of trouble with the missus.
So how far did you actually walk then in total in that 24 hours?
About 82K. So just over a double marathon, yeah.
And if someone would have told you that 3 years ago, if you'd walk that far, you wouldn't have believed them, would you really?
No, I probably would have laughed at them. I probably wouldn't have been able to think that. I probably wouldn't have thought I'd be able to do that, to be honest, when I was able-bodied. Never mind now.
So just to sort of cover that off, and I'm not dismissing what happened to you 3 years ago, but most people are aware that you had an accident that put your life at risk and ended your rugby career back in April 2017. But can you explain to our listeners what happened and what that sort of early prognosis was for yourself?
Yeah, so in 2017, I was playing at the Dragons at that point. So I was sort of 10 years into my career. I had a shoulder injury, so I was recovering from that. So I went back to Bath, to my parents' house, watched the boys play on TV. And then it was a really nice, sort of really nice day. So we went round to our friend's house who had a swimming pool. It was like a feature pool with a waterfall in one end. And where the waterfall hit the water, it disturbed the water, and I dived in thinking it was deep, but it wasn't. It was only about 3 feet. So I smacked my head on the bottom and ended up dislocating my neck, broke it pretty badly, and it left me paralyzed from the shoulders down. Luckily, my dad was in the pool and my mate, they pulled me to the surface, but I'd lost all sensation and all movement from my neck down, and ended up having a 7-hour operation to hopefully try and fix things. Actually ended up being resuscitated 3 times as well. So I actually didn't find that out until a year later. So it puts a sort of different spin on it and how lucky I am to be here. But yeah, it was a serious spinal cord injury. I was told after a week of still no movement that I wasn't going to walk again. But I've been very lucky that since then I got a bit of movement back. And it's been a long sort of 3.5, nearly 4 year process now to try and fight back and get as much movement as possible. And obviously you've just said there that I walked a double marathon, and I say walk, it's more limping with two poles and a foot splint, but I'm back on my feet and I'm independent, which is way more than I ever thought I would be. So it turned out to be a happy ending, if you like.
Yeah, so you dislocated your sort of C6 and C7 vertebrae, which does that make you like a quadriplegic potentially? Is that right? I don't want to put words into your mouth. Is that right? That's what you could have.
Yeah. So I'm an incomplete quadriplegic. Anyone who breaks their neck, actually not breaks their neck. A lot of people can break their neck, but has a spinal cord injury in their neck is quadriplegic. So they have all four limbs that are affected. Anything below their neck, so back breaks, is paraplegic, which means half. So that's just have their two limbs affected.
So you say you were lucky, right? But you know, what part do you play down to luck, and what part do you play in terms of your recovery, to your determination to fight for your independence, I suppose? Because that's one of the key things you wanted, wasn't it, to be independent?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that all comes into, I use the word luck a lot, but I suppose that all comes into luck as well. Like the fact that I was a rugby player at the time, I was playing eight, I was about 18 stone, and I was fit and healthy and had a strong neck, and also recovering from these injuries is spending hours and hours in the physio room, which I was kind of used to, and in the gym. If it was spending hours and hours in front of a computer screen doing spreadsheets, I'd probably still be in a wheelchair, because that'd be completely alien to me. So I was lucky in that respect. I was lucky that my dad was there, and he was a retired doctor, so he knew to keep me still and keep me in the pool. So a lot of damage from these injuries is done actually after the accident, in the way people are handled. And I actually, a bit of bone actually cut my spinal cord in half. So I was sort of hanging by a thread, if you like. So there's a big risk between the point of my accident and getting me on the operating table that it could have been game over. So I was very lucky there were people there doing that. But yeah, of course, there was a lot of effort involved. There still is, you know. I still have to put hours and hours into my rehab and my physio to stay on top of things. But a lot of that comes from my support network, you know, amazing group of family, friends, physios. And again, I'm lucky to have that around me, because not everyone does. And I know the surgeon said that, you know, if a bag of coins got thrown in the air, all of mine ended up heads in terms of how bad my injury was and where I've managed to get to. And all of those coins are things like, you know, being fit and healthy before, having a really good support network, having a dad who's a doctor, you know, all of these sorts of things have really helped me and have played a part in why I'm able to be back on my feet today.
So you have made an amazing recovery, but you still have to say you still have some challenges, because you've got a weakness down one side of your body, and you say, I think your temperature control is not always regulated. How does that affect you in your day-to-day, and what do you have to do to try and improve the prognosis or maintain where you're at, really?
So a lot of the issues that come with the spinal cord injury aren't visible. You know, people assume, you know, it's just the fact you can't move properly, because that's what you can see. But actually, the day-to-day stuff is bladder, bowel, sexual function, temperature regulation, these things that really do change your life, really, and are probably harder to get your head around than the fact you can't move properly. So That's been a process. I still have to use like leg catheter bags sometimes when I'm going out. I still have to, you know, my sleep's still really disturbed because I'm constantly waking up from spasms and all of these sorts of things. And people don't see that side of things. And I think, yeah, that's difficult to deal with sometimes. It can be frustrating, but again, you've got to just put it in perspective to where you could have been, you know. And you said that independence piece early on. I think the fact that I can manage all of those things myself is massive, because a lot of people can't, and they need constant daily support to do that. And that takes away the privacy element, but also it makes them feel like they're impacting on other people. Movement wise, I need to sort of keep on top of things. You know, it's daily, pretty much doing some things, you know, whether it's in the physio room, whether it's training, or just having a good stretch, making sure I keep stretching my hand out, because otherwise that will claw up, all of those sorts of management bits and bobs. But you turn them into habits and daily routines. So, you know, if you, every time you walk past the fridge, for example, you try and do 10 squats, that sort of thing, not necessarily that particularly, but but you kind of get used to it, because otherwise it does grind you down. Like before, when you got injured, when you're playing rugby, you've got a game to aim for or another season to aim for, and you train towards that. But now it's kind of endless. You know, you don't know how far you've got to go. And also, if you stop, you start regressing and going back the other way. And I keep myself motivated, to be honest, by doing these stupid challenges. I put them out there publicly so that I get in trouble, so that I put sort of hamstring myself that I have to do them, and then I need to train towards it. But they really help sort of keep me motivated and stay on top of things.
And that's definitely the best way, you know, live your life loudly in terms of these challenges, and actually come to the, you know, end of the first year of your recovery or post-accident, you set out about challenge of walking up Snowdon. At what stage in your recovery did you set that? Because it's around the anniversary of your accident, so you were trying to walk up Snowdon with a load of mates. When did you say, right, you know, I think I can aim for that and it may be achievable?
Well, I thought it was achievable way before anyone else, apparently, because when I announced it, everyone thought I was nuts. But I was still using my wheelchair a fair bit and sort of walking for rehab. I think by the time I started Snowdon, I'd walked about a mile continuously. But obviously, Snowdon's 9 miles and over 1,000 meters high. So it was definitely a challenge. It was stepping into the unknown in a way, but I really wanted to do it on the 1 year mark, because I wanted to set an example for other people that were in hospital who had been given a sort of negative or guarded prognosis, that maybe there was hope, that they might be able to overturn that, because it's all about hope at the end of the day. You know, if you don't believe there's a possibility you'll get better, then more than likely you won't. I was lucky that I had other people saying there was a chance I would get better, but if I'd listened to what I was being told every day, then I may not have even tried. So I just wanted to set an example. And so we went for it on the 1 year mark, and just, yeah, it was an amazing experience. And I kind of got completely hooked on, but have been hooked on mountains ever since.
Yeah, nothing like an easy thing for you, Ed. But look, I think you had some of your London Welsh former players or mates helping you on that journey as well. I think, which of the guys turned up and helped you climb Snowdon?
Dennis was there, Mike Denby, Millsy was there, John Mills. I remember him trying to prove a point, because I was like, I'm going to beat you to the top. Cause he was well out of shape by that point. I mean, he wasn't in good shape when he was playing, to be honest, but he's always been quite fit, but he'd been retired for a few years by that stage. And so I was like, I was egging him on saying, I'm going to beat him to the top. So he made a point of steaming off ahead, but I think he was more tired by the time we finished it than I was. Who else was there from London Welsh? Alex Davies,
yeah,
came along. So yeah, a few boys. It's been great having them, having the support of the rugby lads through this whole process for a number of reasons. Obviously, physically they can help out with some of the rehab stuff while I was in hospital when the physios weren't there. But more importantly, the banter and like the dark humour that keeps you sane. You know, that they would come in and take the piss straight away, and that's what you want, because you don't want it to be made any more dark or any worse than it already is. You want people to normalize stuff. So if they came in and started being nice to me, it would just be weird, because they never were. So luckily they came in and took the piss.
Yeah, keeps you grounded as well, doesn't it? Which is a key thing.
Exactly,
so,
yeah.
But before you went to Snowdon, you popped to Old Deer Park, because we'd arranged a charity match, hadn't we, for the the Ed Jackson 15 versus the Welsh Charitables, and obviously you weren't able to play, but I had the pleasure of your company in the press box ODP, where I announced the scores and you took the piss out of your mates. It must have been good. It must have been good to be back at ODP to see your mates playing for you and to raise money for Rugby Restart again.
Yeah, no, it was great to be back. Always good fun. And also I had the mic so they couldn't really have any reply. So that was a lot of fun, hurling abuse at them from the back of the stand. It brought back a lot of memories going to Old Deer Park. I've got a lot of great memories there from playing in my first season there, but also just training in over the course of the 2 years and being in and around Richmond and the amazing place it is and the good group of friends we have. So it was nice to have everyone back, you know, because it had been, gosh, I don't know how long it had been. It had been sort of six, seven or eight years probably since we'd been playing there. So a lot of us hadn't seen each other for quite a long time. So it was a good excuse to get all the boys back together.
And obviously a few beers, etc. But look, we'll talk a bit more about London Welsh. But let's go into a bit of your rugby journey and see sort of what happened and how it all started. But you went to senior school at Millfield, yeah? Was that sort of the commencement of your rugby journey, or had you played for a club prior to that?
Well, I'm from Bath, so I've always rugby's kind of a bit of a religion down here in the West Country. So I had played minis and stuff, but actually I played individual sports when I was younger, and I went to Millfield on a. It's obviously a big sports school. I went there on a swimming scholarship. But then after like 4 or 5 weeks of being made to swim for an hour at 6 a.m. every morning before school, I sacked that off pretty quickly and just went to do what my mates were doing. My parents weren't too happy because I had to give up my scholarship. And I think I realise now it's quite an expensive school. But I was pretty miserable. Luckily, I took to pick rugby back up pretty quickly and... I managed to get another scholarship for that sort of a year and a half later. So the damage wasn't too extensive. But I think that was when I started playing seriously, obviously. It's a great rugby school and there's always lots of scouts there. And I got picked up for Somerset, Southwest, and ended up playing England under 16s. And by the time I was 17, I was offered a contract for when I left school with Bath, which was kind of a dream come true for me because it was my hometown club.
I suppose, but you were captain of England in the 16s and England in the 18s. Were there a lot of players of similar quality and played in that setup as well from Millfield, or was it just the odd one? Because didn't Macko and Chris Robshaw go to Millfield, but they're a bit older than you, aren't they, I think?
No, Macko's actually younger than me, even though he looks older than me. Robbo's older than me, yeah, he's 4 or 5 years older than me, but there's a lot of good players that come out of Millfield. My year actually was quite quiet for good players, but I played in the year above quite a lot, and there were some good, really good, so a lot of England Sevens players came out of the year above, so like John Brake, Tom Parker, Mark Odojobi. I remember we run Roslyn Park Sevens, and by the end of it, our total score was 450 points for and 12 against. I think we won the final 50-something nil, but it was a bit ridiculous. But actually, my stepbrother as well, he plays for Bristol, Chris Cook, he was at Bath for a long time. In his year at Millfield, he had Reese Ruddock, who plays for Ireland, Macko Vinopola, Jonathan Joseph. I can't remember that. Yeah, just a ridiculous team that were pretty much all playing international rugby now. So... yeah, it's that type of school, and it's good to be around players like that because you pick up a lot from them.
And Chris Cook is obviously a former London Welsh player as well because he had 6 months.
Oh yeah, of course.
Helping us get promoted to the Premiership the second time around, I think. Under Justin Burnell. But look, so you got signed by Bath, and you were part of their pathway. So as soon as you finished your A levels at Millfield, were you straight into the academy then?
Yeah, I was straight into the academy. Unfortunately, my upper sixth year at Millfield, I dislocated my shoulder for the first time. And then when I signed for Bath, I had like 2 training sessions back and dislocated again. So I nearly missed a year of rugby. Actually nearly ended up retiring then and there. And it was a year after that, you know, I really couldn't get over these shoulder issues and I was going to give it all up. But I took a shot at dropping down a league and moving to Doncaster and playing up there for a season, which was a bit of a culture shock at the time, being a boy who went to a public school in Bath. But then be on all of a sudden on Silver Street in Doncaster. But it was an amazing experience. Actually, most of my family are from South Yorkshire anyway, so it wasn't too it didn't feel too far away from home. But it went from, being injured all the time, holding tackle bags at Bath to playing week in, week out in the Championship, and I probably improved more in that year than I had done in the previous three with a Premiership club. So that was a great experience. And then obviously did enough that year to get picked up by London Welsh and bump up the league a little bit, and the rest is history.
So 3 years at Bath, and obviously a year or so of that was injuries, and then so who was in your sort of age group at Bath then when you were in the academy, and are some of them still there now?
Actually, do you know what? The whole coaching setup seems to be my age group from the academy. They've all sort of retired. Like Nathan Katt's taken over the academy with Mark Lilley. Lewis Messer's doing the backs. But actually, when I was there as a player, the only players who are still playing, well, Matt Banahan's playing, but he was at Gloucester. They've kind of all moved on. It's a bit of a new look team. I think some of the younger kids that were coming through underneath are still there, but you know what it's like these days. The clubs seem to rotate quite quickly, especially in the Premiership. So it looks a bit different than it used to.
It just shows how challenging it is, doesn't it, to make a career as being a rugby player, doesn't it? Every year they have to have so many players in the academy, and it's really challenging to get into that, break into that first team. You go to Doncaster. Did Clive sign you for Doncaster then, or were you just loaned out to Doncaster for the season?
No, it was actually Lynn Howells who signed me for Doncaster. Yeah, so that was my first Welsh coach, and then after that, I only had Welsh coaches at every club I played at.
Yeah. You're even Welsh, are you? So Lynn signed you then.
No.
So Lynn signed you to London Welsh after you had a run of games at Doncaster. So what was your first impression of London Welsh, and how did those transfer talks happen with Lynn, and maybe was Steve Lewis involved as well, I imagine?
Yeah, I mean, you're asking me to think back quite a long time now, but yeah, Steve Lewis was definitely involved. Lynn wasn't involved actually. I got signed by Phil Greening and Simon Amore.
Okay, yes.
No, Mike Friday, sorry, not Simon Amore. Mike Friday and Phil Greening, who were coaches before Lynn. But by the time I arrived, they had both been moved on. And Lynn came. So Lynn didn't actually sign me, which is always a bit awkward when you get picked up by a club, because normally if you sign for a club, you're going because the coach likes you. So you had to kind of prove yourself all over again. But I remember just, it was nice to move down to London. A lot of my schoolmates were in London working, and London Welsh were a better club in the league. So I was really excited. We didn't really seem like we had the team to challenge for the title. That wasn't really our expectations going into the season. We were just there having a good fun. I remember having good fun. I remember it was a really sociable club. John Mills was captain, who wasn't shy of a beer or two. So there was a good atmosphere around the place. And obviously, Lynn Jones is an absolute head case, so that kept training entertaining. So yeah, all in all, it was a good place to go into.
But quite an intelligent man from all accounts, and he kept, as I say, kept training interesting for you guys, didn't he? But the team seemed to have bonded well on and off the pitch, because you say your expectations wasn't to get promoted, but that season you finished fourth, didn't you? So and then obviously we got to the playoffs, but you had an amazing run of games at London Welsh. I think you played in 29 of the 32 league games we played that season, including the playoffs. That's a hell of a lot of games, isn't it, for someone that plays in the back row?
Yeah, it was. That was pretty successful year for me in terms of putting a string of games together, and it was just nice to stay fit for a long time, having had all the shoulder injuries I'd had in the past. So, and I think to improve, you've got to just string games together, and it's difficult when you're at a Premiership club, maybe, and you're a fringe player to get a run of games together. But I just ended up at the right place at the right time. I also had some really stiff competition, but also some great sort of mentors around me. I remember I ended up there at the same time as Dan Brown, Adam Boulding, and Alfie Tuala, who were all like experienced Premiership number eights, but all lovely blokes, and they just wanted to help me improve. And I'm there at like 22, playing in that position, but often, you know, we'd move 8-6, and I learned a huge amount during that season off all of them. So yeah, it was a great year.
Well, you started well because you scored 8 tries in your first 8 appearances.
Yeah, I know. Shame I couldn't keep it up.
Well, you at the end of the season, you were the second highest try scorer behind Hudson Tongaia. It's
Yeah,
not
he
bad, is
wasn't a bad
it?
player either, to be fair.
Yeah,
No.
he's the reason we didn't stay in the Prem, probably, because he didn't stay fit. But look, we'll come on to that. But look, great season, finished fourth, and you say you weren't expected to get into the Prem, but then. Let's get on that sort of bus down to Cornish Pirates. The RFU write the team talk telling us we can't get promoted. Where do you, what how did you feel your chances were in that playoff final then as a team going down to Cornwall?
We were, you know, obviously you get to that stage, you're hopeful, but with going down to Pirates, and they hadn't lost there for quite a long time, and we'd been thumped there earlier on in the regular season, so it was kind of like we'll give it our best shot. But I remember when the RFU made that announcement, you can kind of react one of two ways. You can kind of just roll over and be like, well, what's the point? We can't get promoted anyway. Or the other thing happened, it just pissed us all off, to be honest. And it really gave us that motivation to kick up the arse the next day to show them, to shove it up them really. And Cornish Pirates got on the receiving end because, I mean, you've probably got the score in front of you. I can't remember it exactly, but I think we put the performance of the season in down at a very tough place to go. And we kind of left ourselves with not much work to do after that.
Yeah, so I think I haven't got it in front of me, but I think it's, you won it come like 41, and they were in the teens, so it made the second leg, your second leg was more or less done and dusted. So, but obviously the celebrations post the second leg was great for everyone, really. But obviously we still weren't promoted then, but the boys or the players still had to go out and celebrate maybe the chances of getting into the Prem. So you were all out at ODP till 6, 7 in the morning, then into town, weren't you?
Yeah. I remember we were all on the train with the commuters on, because the game was on a Wednesday night for some reason. We played Wednesday night over two legs. We were at Old Deer Park, and I can remember the championship trophy. It's not a cup, it's a trophy. It's got no bowl in it. So me and Millsy taped a load of Jaeger bombs to it for a team photo, because normally, you fill the trophy with beer or something. And we got a phone call or a message from the RFU or from Championship Rugby saying, please take down that photo and stop disrespecting the trophy. And I think Millsy was drunk and replied, it's our trophy now, so we'll do what we want with it. But we ended up on the train into town with all the commuters in the morning, obviously, all of us with our London Welsh polos on. And it was probably the highlight of my career, to be honest, because I think it was so unexpected. And there were so many players in the team that never even dreamt that they would have a chance to play in the Premiership. You know, for most people in the Championship or the lower leagues, that's your aim. That is the dream, to one day play Premiership rugby. And all of a sudden, there's all these people that never thought they would get there, thinking, "Wow, next year there's a real chance. We're going to be mixing it with the big boys." So the atmosphere was incredible.
So you knew you'd be going to Prem because you probably had a 2-year contract. But then Lynn and the London Welsh management team brought in quite a few new players. We got a front five more or less from that French Division Two team, like Briggsy, Montanella all came along. But the preparation time for the Prem season was quite short, wasn't it? So we were sort of on the back foot from a preparation perspective and a funding perspective. But the team. The team culture was strong, wasn't it? And that really helped us get a kickstart into the season, didn't it, really?
Yeah, definitely. We had, I mean, I don't want to blow too much smoke up his arse, and I hope he doesn't listen to this, but Millsy was is it was definitely the best captain that I played for. He just had this way of like creating a very calm atmosphere amongst the squad, and no one was able to take themselves too seriously, and it was a very easy place to come and fit into. There was no egos, and I think even though there was a fair bit of change bringing players in that second year, we molded very quickly because of that, because I think the senior players were that way, And that the way the senior players are always drift sort of sets the tone for the rest of the squad. And it meant we bonded pretty quickly, and actually we had a pretty good start. And of course we didn't have anything to lose. You know, no one expected us to even win a game. So and that is actually a nice place to be when you go into a season, because there's absolutely no pressure. At the start, teams were sort of putting change teams out against us, but then obviously we started winning a few games and sent the shockwave through the league a little bit.
Well, you certainly helped that cause because you scored your first try in the Prem against Exeter, which was our first win with Seb Jewell's conversion, and we won at Sale 5 days later. So, yeah, then so the first 6 months were really, really, really strong for London Welsh, and then obviously it started to unfold, I suppose. What was that like? Because you got injured in February and didn't play again for London Welsh, but then there's a few events, wasn't it, that sort of unfolded sort of post Christmas, which just meant we sort of lost momentum and didn't have maybe the strength in depth that other squads might have had, really.
Yeah, there were a couple of key moments. I think one of them was before Christmas when we lost to Saris, when they blew up on a reset scrum, and we were on their 5 meter line, and we had pumped them, and it was going to be a penalty try. You've seen it a thousand times, and we would have beaten Saracens. I think that would have meant we had gone to like seventh in the league by Christmas. Who was the referee?
I know who it
I can't.
was.
It was who was it?
Luke Pearce.
Yeah, Luke Pearce, because I've had this banter with him before, and he's admitted he was wrong, but and I was like, don't worry, mate, you just ruined 30 careers. But he's actually a good ref, to be fair, and it
And
really
not
and
his,
a,
though. Did ruin his, did
no, didn't really hear his. He's done really
it?
well, really, really well off the back of it. Cheers, Piercy, if you're listening. But anyway, and then after Christmas, I think two things happened: strength and depth told. You know, a few key injuries. You've got to have more, money tells, because you can't. Yeah, you can have a good starting 15 or 20 or 23, but then you can't afford to have the depth that the Premiership's teams do. And it's a long season, attritional season in the Premiership, and so injuries started happening, and we fell behind a bit. But I still think we had enough in the tank to stay up. But then obviously we got docked points for fielding an eligible player with Tyson Keats. So there was all of that fiasco, and that kind of put the nail in the coffin at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, definitely disappointing, but it's a great season to see London Welsh in the Premiership, and I'm sure you guys all, enjoyed the level of competition. It also put you in the shop window, things like that. So, you then went to Wasps after London Welsh. So, just not that I'm wanting to give us any sort of confidential information, but at what stage does a player who's on a 2 year contract think about, their next move or staying with Welsh? Would you have been talking sort of towards the second half of that season, with Wasps about moving there, or is it just after the end of the season you might think, oh, actually, I don't want to play Championship, I might get a chance at another club in the Prem?
So I actually signed a I think I'd signed a 2 year with I either signed a 3 year with Welsh at the start, or I signed a 2 year after my first year at Welsh, so when we went up to the Premiership. So I actually had another year on my contract. But Di had tried to sign me, or was considering signing me for Doncaster, and it didn't actually happen at the time, but he'd stayed in contact with me. And then when London Welsh got relegated, I think if we had stayed up, I would have stayed at Welsh. But when we got relegated, Di and Lynn obviously know each other, being Welsh coaches, and Di said to cut that, you should come over to Wasps. And to be fair and Welsh actually tried to block it for a bit so that I would go back and play in the Championship with them. But I think, to be fair to Lynn, he realised, like, I'm still only 23 or 24 at the time. It's a big opportunity for me. So, I still loved London Welsh, the club, but it was an opportunity I couldn't sort of turn down. And so I probably knew by it was well, it was when we confirmed that we weren't going to be staying up, which wasn't actually till quite late on. But that decision had been made: if we don't go down, then I'm going over to Wasp by sort of February, March time. But I've been speaking to Di for 2 years, pretty much. And to be honest, staying at Welsh up until that point and probably not jumping over to Wasps at from Doncaster was a good thing, because obviously, as you've pointed out, you know, playing 29 games, you know, so in concession pretty much was great for my development, and I would have missed out on all the fun as well. But it put me in a good position then heading over to Wasps.
Well, look, in 2 years, 52 appearances for London Welsh, 42 in the league, 39 starts, 14 tries. Not bad for number eight. And it's no wonder Wasps signed you as Billy Vunipola's replacement, is it?
No, they didn't sign me as Billy Vunipola's replacement. They signed Nathan Hughes as Billy Vunipola's replacement. So I turned up at the same time as him, which was great because it was great. Well, I had loads of weekends off then.
How did your time at Wasps go then? Because, you know, they're an established Premiership club, you know, a deeper squad, so harder to get that starting berth potentially. So, you know, you'd have known that signing for them. So what, you know, so you want to take your career up to another level, more competition. So how do you feel your time at Wasps went then?
It started off really well. Like, I actually, after pre-season, I'd fought my way into the starting side. So I started the double header at what against Quinns at Twickenham, first game of the season, and you know, it was 100% capacity then, so it was like 80,000 people in Twickenham, and so it was a serious step up. All of a sudden I was like, well, it's a bit different to playing at the Kassam, but it was and I strung a good run of games together again, but then got injured, and then Nathan started coming through, you know, and he's obviously a great player. And when Hask was fit as well, Sam Jones, it was really competitive. But I played plenty of rugby there, a lot of the time, either off the bench or in the LV Cup and stuff. I actually captained them a couple of times as well. Had a great, you know, there's a great group of friends from there. I'm still friends with a lot of them too. And I sort of established myself as a decent squad player. And it actually came to, when it came to the end of my second year, that was when Lynn got in touch with me again and said that I'm taking over at Dragons. When Di comes to speak to you about re-signing, just let me know, because we'd love to sort of make you an offer and give you another opportunity. And I think when that time came around, I was 27, or 26, the hopes of playing for England had kind of passed, and I just fancied a new challenge, because I'd done it before, going from a Premiership club, and moving to Dragons isn't dropping down a league or anything, but in terms of competition for places, there was more chance I'd get more game time, and I'd reap the rewards of that, and I just wanted to be playing rugby. Plus, I had a lot of friends in Cardiff. It was a city that I loved anyway, and it would be a new challenge, and Lynn would be coaching, so I knew it would be a lot of fun. So actually, I kindly turned down the position at what, you know, Di offered me another 2-year contract, but I knew it was to be a squad player, and that was fine. I was really enjoying myself, but there was a chance to go to the Pro 14, experience a new league, play more rugby. So I kind of jumped at the chance, really, and the next thing I knew, I was living in Cardiff, playing for the Dragons.
So actually, you know, that's quite interesting, actually, because you know, how do you compare Di and Lynn as coaches? Because Di's gone to Cardiff now, coach Cardiff Blues as an interim, but I imagine he'll move to director of rugby with Dwayne Peel coming in next year as head coach. How do you compare someone like Di and someone like Lynn? And then also, how different were the environments between Wasps and London Welsh? Because were you training in Acton at that time, or are they in Coventry?
Yeah, well, we trained at Acton, and then we trained at Acton the whole time. But we played first year, we were playing in High Wycombe. Second year, we moved to Coventry.
Right.
The personnel wise, it was pretty similar. There was quite a lot of jokers at the top of the tree. You had like Haskell, Goody. The atmosphere was actually really good. Professionalism probably stepped up a little bit, a notch, because of it being a Premiership club, and I think there isn't as big a gulf between the Championship and the Premiership as people think in terms of playing ability. There's probably, the main difference is pace, like speed of the game, but physically the step up wasn't massive. You know, the Championship's a really physical league. They both had really good atmospheres as clubs. Di Dai and Lin, they're reasonably different coaches. Like, I think they're both very intelligent in their own right. Dai's a bit more reserved than Lin. Like, Lin likes his wacky ways around things. I think they're both excellent coaches. I think Lin's a bit of an actual is actually a bit of a crazy genius. I just think he struggles to get it across sometimes. I'm not sure I've played for a more intelligent coach than him. But Dai, Dai was amazing with me. He's always been really honest, and you can't say that about a lot of coaches. He was always up front with me. I feel very lucky to have played for the coaches. I feel very lucky to play for the coaches I have throughout my career. At Bath, I was only really dealing with the junior coaches or the academy coaches, and who were all great. And then by the time I moved to Donny Linhouse, he was old, and he was sort of moving. He was sort of getting to the end of his rugby career, but he was a lovely bloke. Lin, obviously, crazy genius. I always got on well with him. Not everyone did, but I did. And Dai, straight up honest bloke, which is all you can ask for from a coach, to be honest. So they're all great coaches, but in different ways.
Could you ever see both them helping Wales do well in the Six Nations? A Dai and Lin dream ticket.
Do you know what? I don't know about that. They're so diff. They're quite different. They're quite different, I think, and they're both probably quite strong-minded about the ways they would play the game. I wouldn't probably chuck them in together. They would both. I both back them to do a good job leading the charge for Wales, but probably not hand in hand.
Yeah, possibly. So when you're at Wasps, so before we get to Newport Gwent Dragons, there was a certain young Will Taylor around the squad when you were there, who's obviously now our S&C coach. So what sort of impression did the young Will Taylor make on a young N Jackson?
Tails was yeah, it was good fun. Like, we used to have he became a good mate of mine pretty quickly, and I think it's quite weird. I always get confused that Will's obviously so involved with London Welsh, and I'm good mates with Will, but actually I know him from Wasps. He's a great bloke. He's a slightly different shape than when I first met him, that's for sure. He was probably it look he old Will could probably eat new Will. But he looks like he's doing a great job down there at London Welsh, and I know for a fact he's absolutely loving it. So it's good to see. A lot of boys struggle with their transitions out of rugby, and he had to retire pretty early at 25, I know it was tough for him to start with, but he seems to be in a great place right now, or at least he tells me he is. And obviously he's in a good part of the world there at London Welsh in Richmond. So I'm sure he'll keep going from strength to strength.
No, he's definitely loving life at London Welsh, and yeah, really enjoying it. So you're back at Newport Gwent Dragons. You play in a Pro 14 for the first time for a couple of years. You play 36 matches across those 2 years. So what was your how did you enjoy that experience? Because obviously Newport Gwent Dragons, when Wales are playing, they chuck, there'd be five, six, seven, eight players going to Wales camp. So you had more opportunity to play them because of that as well, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I went in, and the first year, I was playing a lot of six alongside Toby Faletau, which was an amazing experience because he's still probably the best player I've ever played with or trained with, and a great guy. And it was interesting when I first turned up there. Obviously, with my accent being reasonably posh and English, turning up at a Gwent team that's made up of Valleys, pretty much all Valleys boys. I had to keep my mouth shut, but then you play a few games, you do your talking on the pitch, and they were a great bunch, loads of fun. Like, we struggled a bit rugby wise in terms of winning games, but it was really enjoyable season for me. And actually, my rugby really moved on. I spent a bit of time on the sidelines injured, but I strung enough games together, and by the time I got to the end of those 2 years, I'd re-signed for another two. So it was the first time I was going to spend that length of time at a club. I was completely, me and my wife were completely settled in Cardiff, and that was going to be it for the foreseeable, really. That was how well it was going, and that's how much I was enjoying it.
Well, so you talk about Toby Faletau. What makes him, that special player? You said about training and playing, but we've obviously seen him play so well for Lions. But on a day-to-day level, you're seeing him train and perform, next to him on the pitch. What makes him stand out amongst, other players you've been playing around with?
He's just finds the game so easy. Like his hands, his footwork, the size and speed of him, like you don't really realize until you're up close. But he does everything with such ease, and he's always so relaxed, and that like calm that has a calming influence on everyone around him. I don't know whether it's because he's not bothered. That might be the case, but whatever. He doesn't play like he's not bothered, but his facial expressions suggest he's not bothered. But he just finds rugby really easy. And you like when you he'll go and kick with the kickers and kick better than with them. He'll go and do handling with the backs and handle better than them. He'll go and do running with the wingers and be faster than them. He's just one of those guys, and he's a great bloke on top of it as well. You know, great fun, really chilled out, modest. Yeah, couldn't speak highly enough of him.
Oh, that's great. So yeah, you re-sign for Newport Dragons, and then your accident happens. We've covered the first year of your accident. So post rugby now, you've got lots of things going on. I mean, you seem so busy, and you got fingers in lots of different things. So what does post rugby mean for Ed? Because you this summer you walked the Pennine Way, so that was your big charity event for, well, one of them for 2020. Some may have been cancelled due to COVID. So why did you do the Pennine Way? And did you walk that with your wife, yeah?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, because it's been a weird year with COVID, you're right, we did have a lot of charity events cancelled, and I've started my own charity as well. But actually, I was trying to raise money to support the other charities that I'm involved with, and in particular, that one was Wings for Life, who are a spinal cord injury research charity. So they're trying to find a cure for spinal cord injuries. And the Pennine Way is known as the Spine of England, because it runs right down the middle. It links the Pennines down 268 miles down the middle, pretty much linking all the national parks up. And so because we couldn't really get abroad, we decided to do that over 16 days, which worked out like 19, 20 miles a day. And it was absolutely brutal. Like it was to do that back to back, to do that on one day for me is ridiculously hard. It was over moorland and peat bogs the whole way, so it wasn't like we were walking on a track. By the time we finished, we'd summited the height of Everest twice, and it was just getting up in the morning and going again, wet kit the whole time. And we picked 2 weeks in August that there were two storms big enough to have names. Like, what are the chances of that in the middle of August? It was ridiculous, but and you know you always look back on these challenges and you forget how much they hurt, and you look at how much money you raise, and you sign yourself up for the next one. But I'm not afraid to say that's the hardest thing I've the hardest challenge I've ever done, and it wasn't supposed to be. It was supposed to be a nice walk through the English countryside in the middle of summer to raise some cash. But I suppose you know you've got to justify the fundraising in a way, and I think we definitely earned it that time.
Didn't you camp out some nights as well, or did you always stay in accommodation in between each day?
No, we camped out some nights as well. Luckily, we had support with us at different points, because my family, like I said, are all from up north. So sometimes we'd get picked up and drop back off and stay with people. Sometimes we'd stay with pubs. A couple of times we'd camp, and then we'd sort of carry our kit we needed for sort of 2 or 3 days, and then we'd link up with someone else who would then swap our kit out and take it away and wash it, so we didn't have to carry 2 weeks worth of kit and tents the whole time. Otherwise, I just don't think we probably wouldn't have made it, to be honest.
So you take these challenges on because you say you're for the charity Wings for Life, but you're also a brand ambassador for Berghaus, right? As part of that, say contract or whatever it is, you've got an arrangement with them. Do you have to do these challenges, or they just say, "Just here you go. Here's a load of gear to wear when you choose to do them."
No, I don't have to do anything for them, to be honest. Berghaus have been unbelievable, and actually, I'm not an official amb. I became official app ambassador for Berghaus yesterday.
I'm
So
on top
I've
of things,
literally,
Ed.
yeah, you're on top of things. I'm in the middle of writing a post about it right now, which is going to go out this evening. So that's impressive from you. But no, I got introduced to them back in 2 years ago, and before we first went to Nepal, because I just had a mate of a mate who knew them, and I was just hoping for some free socks or something. And they bought into the story, and they've just supported me ever since. They didn't want anything in return. You know, they honestly, all of the promotion I do for them is completely off my own back. They never asked me for anything. They've not only sort of helped me out with kit and advice, they're also helping design new kit as I go higher and further that will help me with my disabilities. They donated 10 grand to our partner charities yesterday when I, sorry, last year when I was doing the stair climb. They've just been incredible. And I, you know, I thought they were German when we first started, you know, Berghaus. They're from Sunderland. So they're like a proud British brand, and it's great to officially be involved with them. And yeah, hopefully I can give a bit back to them as well as them helping me, because it's kind of having a brand like that behind you and the expertise involved really gives me the confidence to sort of keep going higher, keep going further, and obviously help spread the word about the charity and helps with our fundraising as well. So yeah, it's a great partnership.
That's amazing. I forgot about that staircase challenge you did, like walking up the stairs, your parents' house, the equivalent of Mount Everest. But look, the key thing here is, like, you've got your own charity foundation called Millimeters to Mountains. What's the idea behind it, and how do you, how do people get involved or in that charity? How can they raise money for it? How can they support you in your quest? So what's the ethos behind that charity, Ed? Sorry.
So Millimeters to Mountains came about when I was doing these climbs, mostly for Restart, because I wanted to pay them back all of the money they had supported me during my rehab. But I was on these climbs, and I was feeling the benefits for myself, not just physically, but mostly emotionally, of being outdoors, overcoming challenges that I didn't think I was able to. And we were raising money for lots of people back home, but I felt the real power would be to get those people out to take the challenges on. The real reward was in actually taking them on, because I was seeing the difference it was making, not just for me, but for other people who might not necessarily have anything on paper serious going on in their lives. Obviously, we've all got crap going on in our lives. You know, everyone's got their own mountains to climb, excuse the cliche. But I thought if we could take people who were really struggling and really needed a change, or, you know, had mental health issues or whatever it was, to the mountains taking these challenges, that would be great. And I was very lucky that I had the resources, or I was able to go on these trips, but most people don't. You know, it's expensive to go to the other side of the world, to go to the Alps, to go to Nepal and go on these adventures. So that's what we do as a charity. We find beneficiaries who maybe are struggling with mental health problems, whether that be something that's come out of trauma or PTSD, or as a result of a physical disability, or maybe it might be a medical form of depression, whatever it might be. We use the adventure as a catalyst for change, and then we put an aftercare program involved afterwards for 1 to 3 years, where it'll be life coaching, work experience. We'll help fund courses, anything like that, to try and get their life back on track, kind of in the same way. You know, I benefited from doing those challenges. We want to offer that to other people. But we're also donating money towards Spinal Unit in Nepal, which I'm quite heavily involved with, to help build another one of those and to help fund the running costs of it. So there's lots of different things going on. We actually achieved official charity status last year. We've been raising money for other charities up until that point, but now we're raising money for ourselves, and we're taking our first beneficiaries away this year, hopefully COVID permitting. So we got two trips to the Alps, one to Iceland, and we're going to Nepal for a month as well, and we've got a big walk down in Cornwall. So plenty going along as long as COVID buggers off. And if you want to get involved, either join us on any of the trips or just donate, then go to millimeterstomountains.org, or you can find all of the handles through my social media stuff on if you just go to edjackson8, it's all on there.
Yeah, look, we'll put the link up for the charity on the podcast episode page, things like that, so people can. And so you raise money through sponsorships by doing these events, I suppose, shall we say. Is it like the charity walks up the mountains with the beneficiaries, and people sponsor you to do that? Is that how you raise money?
Yeah, well, actually, there's beneficiary places on the climbs, but the rest of the places are taken up by fundraisers. So we might have 10 people who come along on the adventure and will pay their way. We'll subsidize the cost of the trip a bit, but then they'll fundraise. And then we'll have a couple of paid places for beneficiaries on there too. So we fundraise in that way. We also have donations from people doing their own challenges, and we're on Just Giving, so people can raise money for us however they want. And then being involved with businesses, other companies that are trying to get on their CSR programs is how we do it. But we're very early stage, so we're very open. Any support we can get, to be honest, at this stage.
No, that's understandable. You're also seen on TV quite a bit now because you've got a gig for Channel 4 Rugby. So how did that come about, and how did you and they prepare you for that?
Well, I started speaking in hospitals after my accident because I made quite an unprecedented recovery. So they wanted to know how, given the nature of my injury. And then from there, it snowballed when I spoke to schools, universities, and then businesses. And someone along the way was spying on me doing one of my talks. And Channel 4 were putting a team together. And they wanted a team of new faces. They didn't want to just sort of nick Flats and Ben Kay and stuff. They wanted to put a new team together. So they rang me and I just couldn't believe it. I was like, I've never done TV work before and you want me to go straight in as the reporter. So the next thing I knew, it was only 2 months later, I was down at the rec for Bath versus Toulouse, and it was me, Gareth Thomas, Jamie Heaslip and Brian Abana. And I was like, what is going on? And they like no training, just straight in the deep end, like sink or swim. So it's been, I'm very lucky to have been given that opportunity, and it's been great to have another challenge to focus on. And also it kind of replaces the rugby in a sense, in terms of it is a real team effort. There's 50 people there putting on a rugby production for TV, and everyone's got their own job to do. And if you don't do it well, it affects the rest of the team. It's exactly like playing a game. And you know, live TV is the same thing. It's like the red light comes on. If you mess up, you know, you haven't got another shot at it. It's like playing a game. So there's that nerves beforehand, and then there's that relief afterwards. And that's something that I suppose I've got used to over the years with rugby. And I think that's a gap that people miss after they finish playing. That's something that people struggle to replace. So I feel very lucky to be in a position that I can, and things are ramping up this year as I'm going out as one of the presenters on the Paralympics, which goes from being hundreds of thousands of viewers to millions of viewers. So just try not to think about it.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing, because your live TV is challenging, and just to throw you in there with the producer speaking to you one ear, you trying to interview someone else on live telly with no training whatsoever. You've made a leap so well, Ed. You look so comfortable in that environment. But your debut was a game that Freddie Burns got that slap down, wasn't it? Is that the game?
Yeah. Yeah, that was game. It's a good mate of mine as well. So I really enjoyed that one. God, I tell you what, trying to interview, that happened right at the end of the match. And then next thing you know, you're interviewing Todd Blackadder, the Bath coach. He's about 6'6", 6'7". He's looking down at you. And I can tell you, he was not happy. And it's my first ever live interview. I was like, what are you going to say to Freddie? He was like, nothing.
You had a quiet word in his ear before it went live, though, to say, look, be nice to me. It's my first one, yeah?
Yeah, right. He wasn't in the mood for any small talk, I tell you.
That's the challenging part of that job, though, isn't it? You know, someone's happy because they've won. Someone's unhappy because they've lost. You're having to get some sort of feedback from both of them. That's quite a challenging job, really, isn't it? It doesn't look like that way sometimes on television, but it is quite challenging to get the right words and ask the right questions to those DORs, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fun. It's like a game sometimes. And but all of them are very professional. I've interviewed Eddie Jones a few times. He likes trying to mess with you, give you one word answers and stuff, because he knows you've probably only prepared 3 or 4 questions, so he's trying to take you to question 10. But I enjoy that. Again, it's that high pressure to and fro. And I think because I'm an ex-player, I think, and relatively recently, I think that helps and works in my favour sometimes, because a lot of the time I'll know the players I'm interviewing, for example, so they'll give me the time of day, if you like. But also, if they take it down a rugby chatty route, I still can probably hold my own at the moment. Give me 10 years and I probably won't, because I won't know who any of the players are anymore. Well, I will have if I've carried on working in the game, but most of them at the moment, I know who they are, I know what their missus is called, and I know all the dirty secrets on them, so they've got to be nice to me.
And that's what matters at the end of the day. Look,
exactly.
I was going to ask, right, what next for Ed Jackson, but you've just gone through the year, well, you know, potentially if COVID goes away, there's a lot of speculation that the Olympics might have happened, so the, you know, and the Paralympics might have happened, but let's say it's going to happen. You go to Nepal, you go to the Paralympics in Tokyo, probably in August. You're going to do some more walks in the Alps again, I suppose. You go to Cornwall. Is that to do the South Coast Trail or something? Is that what you're doing there?
Yeah, Southwest Coast Path, yeah.
It's a great book, isn't it, called The Salt Path, isn't it? Have you read that?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's anyway, that's just shows I read a book occasionally.
Yeah,
So and also you do motivational talks, public speaking to companies like Facebook or Microsoft. So we're lucky to get this hour with you, Ed, really, aren't we? For London Welsh Rugby Club podcast.
anything for London Welsh, mate.
Look, when you look back on your career, and it's obviously taken off post rugby, which is unbelievable. I'm so chuffed for you. But when you reflect on your career, what do you hold dear about your memories at London Welsh and your time there?
I mean, winning the championship, I mean, obviously was absolutely massive. But some of the characters that were there that I'm still really good friends with, you know, Millsy's now moved back to Bristol from Manchester, so I still see him relatively regularly. Still good mates with Welly, Alex Davies, and Mike Denby. And Mike Denby, actually, and now I live back in the southwest. Mike Denby's parents live, you know, not very far away, so he comes back here quite regularly. So it's like with rugby, you know, it's not about, for me, it's not about the things you achieve or who you end up playing for. It's more about the connections you make. And some might say playing for five different clubs, you know, you're a bit of a journeyman or whatever, but actually it just means I've got five times as many friends. And that's what I take away from my rugby career, some great relationships and some great mates, and a lot of them came from London Welsh, and you can't steal memories off people. So you know, yeah, it was a great 2 years of my career, but one that I still get to hang around with the players that were there, and we still reminisce about old times, and we probably still will be annoying people with our chat about winning a championship when we're 70 and 80, hopefully.
Fingers crossed you do. Look at
In
Ed.
fact, I remember, you just reminded me, after we won that, so we went ended up on the piss, obviously, and it was a Wednesday, and I ended up going to Bournemouth Sevens that weekend, and I turned up on the Saturday, and I was wearing my London Welsh medal as the champions medal as a tie, and the Bristol team were in the VVIP area, because it was like, I can't remember, it was one of the boys' birthdays, so I wandered in there with the championship medal as a tie, going, "All right, lads." They weren't best impressed.
Well, they didn't even make the final, did they? So never mind. But look, Ed,
No.
thanks for your time. I look forward to following your career, right? And please come back to ODP and watch London Welsh with Kai and Steve Shings, and Will sort of steering the ship. And fingers crossed, we get some community rugby next September. But look, good luck with your charity, and I say appreciate your time today. So all the best, Ed. Thank you.
Cheers, Gareth.